Micah 6. Listen to this quote. This could easily have been written by an 8th century prophet to Israel, a man like Micah. Quote, "We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power, as no other nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace and which multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. And we have vainly imagined that in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace. Too proud to pray to the God that made us." Now, those words could easily have been spoken by Micah because they express perfectly what's going on in the 8th century BC in Israel and Judah, God's people, and yet because of unbroken success militarily and financially for about 2 or 3 generations, they were absolutely apostate by the time these prophets came on the scene. As it is, those words were actually spoken by Abraham Lincoln a little over 100 years ago about our own nation. And it hasn't gotten a lot better in a little over 100 years in our nation. In fact, it's gotten worse. The parallels between what's going on in our culture and what was going on in Israel in the 8th century BC are remarkable. We have a culture in which we've been blessed and we have a godly heritage, and yet there's such widespread drifting that in order to preach the gospel freely in public places, one must now travel behind the old iron curtain. It's an interesting thing. I was talking to some guys just recently about going there, which I will be doing in October to teach at a Bible college in Minsk. And they said, it is absolutely amazing how open people are behind the iron curtain. Public schools inviting Christian teachers to come in and explain the gospel and teach the Bible. Can you imagine that going on here? ACLU would have kittens. Well, that's what was going on in Israel. You see, that same kind of backsliding, that same kind of foolish, arrogant, prideful, we don't need God. Well, a nation doesn't go on that way for very long without the Lord reminding them of their need. And it is the job of the prophets in the Old Testament to do precisely that, to remind Israel of their need. The pre-exilic prophets, the prophets before the exile, who ministered between the death of Solomon and the Babylonian captivity, had basically one message to bring to Israel. Actually, it was a message of judgment and hope, so I suppose it's two messages. They were constantly warning Israel about their apostasy, and you should be getting a feel now for some of the poetry of these prophets and for some of the fabulous writing that they did, and it is rich, wonderful writing. The prophet's job was to explain to the people of God that God had a case against them, that he had every reason to expect that they would listen to him, but they had not listened to him. Have you ever been angry with someone? Righteously, of course, we all think we're righteously angry, right? Whenever we're angry, it's always righteous. It's my anger, isn't it? But a real legitimate time when you thought to yourself, you know, this is really wrong, what they have done. I mean, really wrong. I may have my problems with my motives, and I may have my problems with my carnality, but what they did is really, really, really wrong. And there's a sense of self-righteous anger that wells up inside at moments like that. And it's never unmixed with sin, because we are mixed with sin. And yet, you know the feeling. You know the feeling of being upset and knowing that it's right to be upset about something. This thing is, what's going on here? You think God has feelings like that? Yes, with perfect righteousness. In fact, whenever God is angry, it's a perfect anger. It's an absolutely righteous anger. And indeed, that is the message of the prophets. They were to come and they were to tell God's people that they had been morally and ethically and spiritually responsible and had completely turned away from the Lord. In that little tiny bit of anger that we feel sometimes, that little small portion of it that's righteous inside, that makes us just grind away at the injustices we see or whatever. Multiply that times a million. Give it the purity of God Himself. And you have an inkling of how God feels when He speaks to people, redeems people, changes people, and they run away from Him. He offers them everything, and they turn and spit in His face. It is that communication that these prophets bring to the nation of Israel. It is that sense of God's indignation against the nation of Israel that the prophets bring. And it is a thread woven into all the tapestry constantly in the prophets. And we get into chapters 6 and 7 of Micah, the last two chapters of Micah. And Micah is a prophecy or a series of prophecies woven also with hope as well as judgment. But we get into these last two chapters and it's very picturesque. Because as we saw last time, in chapters 3, 4, and 5, he talks about the future, but in chapters 6 and 7, he comes back to the present time, 8th century B.C., and the horrible circumstances facing the nation of Israel. In these two chapters, Micah speaks the heart of God, and then there's a little dialogue, and we'll see this dialogue. First, Micah speaks directly for the Lord in the indictment against the people. Then Micah speaks sort of on behalf of what the people are saying. Then he speaks for the Lord again. Then he speaks for himself, and then he tells the future of what's going to happen. So watch for that pattern as we go through it. Chapter 6 begins the final section of the book of Micah, the third great oracle, and it begins again with the word hear. Hear now what the Lord is saying. Arise, plead your case before the mountains. Let the hills hear your voice. Listen, you mountains, to the indictment of the Lord. And you enduring foundations of the earth, because the Lord has a case against his people, even with Israel, he has a dispute. Now, Israel, as you remember, there was a small remnant of real believers within Israel, but the vast majority of the people in Israel were not true believers, though as a nation, they were called by his name. And so, he says, I have a dispute, and the dispute, of course, is not with the remnant, it's with the nation as a whole and all of the apostasy. And he calls creation, notice, he calls creation to be the witness. Everybody needs a witness, and in a court scene, which is being described here, it's a court scene with God saying, I have a case against my people, and he calls creation as the witness. Watch this. Listen to this. And we've seen this over and over in the prophets. Now, why does a prophet, under the anointing of God, call upon creation to stand as a witness against humanity? It's because all creation knows God, except us. We are the rebellious creatures. Every other creature on earth is doing essentially what it was created to do, except us. We are not worshiping God, and we are not being loyal to God. All the rest of the creatures on the earth are suffering under the curse. Romans chapter 8, the whole creation groans, being burdened, waiting for the redemption of the sons of God, waiting for the remnant of the people who really believe God. What's wrong with creation? Us! That's what's wrong with creation. We have goofed it up. And it's not by using aerosol cans and blowing a hole in the ozone layer. It's by sin. Blew a hole in the righteousness layer. Okay? And we've been in trouble ever since. And the whole earth has been under the curse because of human sin. And so God says to creation, look at this. I created the mountains. The mountains did what I said. I said, come up out of the sea. The mountains came up out of the sea. I said to human beings, morally responsible beings created in my image, do what I say. They said, no, thank you. So, creation, you stand as a witness because I have a beef with my people and I'm going to let you know what it is. Verse 3, my people, he says. Now he turns to the people. This is the voice of God. Now remember that sense of frustration that you feel sometimes, a righteous kind of frustration where you know something's really wrong and you know it's not really your fault and you have this deep sense of indignation. That's called indignation. Verse 3, my people, what have I done to you and how have I wearied you? Answer me. Can you imagine the Lord saying this? It's awesome. What have I done to you that you should turn away this way, that you should treat me this way? He says, answer me. How have I wearied you? Now, the Hebrew word there for Wearied means to make tired or exhausted or to wear down. How have I worn you down? What were they saying to him? Well, you've just worn us down. Such a pain following you. It's so hard to be your people. Look at them. Better than they've ever been in their whole national history, almost, except under David. 8th century BC was the most prosperous time since King David and Solomon. And yet they're saying, oh, it's so wearisome, it's so bothersome to be devoted to God. God says, really, how have I worn you down? How have I hurt you? Indeed, verse 4, I brought you up from the land of Egypt. I ransomed you from the house of slavery. I sent before you Moses and Aaron and Miriam. What do you mean? Have I done wrong to you? I sent you these leaders. I brought you out of Egypt. My people, remember now. And if you circle things or write things in your Bible, circle the word remember. Remember now what Balak, king of Moab, counseled and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered him. And from Shittim to Gilgal, in order that you might know the righteous acts of the Lord. Now that doesn't make a lot of sense to us, but it did to them, because you see, Balak and Balaam, Balak was a king that tried to have Israel destroyed by the use of spiritism, and Balaam was a spiritist for hire. He was a hired spiritual gun, and he was hired to curse the nation of Israel back in Numbers 22, and God caught him. Balak said, Balaam, I'll pay you a lot of money. You ride your donkey out here. Remember that's the guy that the donkey stopped and talked to, right? Remember Balaam? Well, Balak was hiring Balaam to come out and curse the nation of Israel from the mountaintops around Moab. And Balaam came out to do that for money, and God wouldn't let him do it. He opened his mouth, bless these people. And Balak's going, bless them? No, no, wait a minute. Stop that. I want my money back. He says, well, okay, we'll try again. We'll try again. That's okay. We'll try again. All right. You read the story, you know. And Balaam says, no, I can still earn my money. So they find another mountaintop, and he says, okay, curse him. Here's your money. Curse him. And Balaam goes, bless these people, Lord. May they multiply and defeat all their enemies. And Balak is going, wait a minute. Stop. Wait a minute. Let's try it again. So they tried it again, and every time he blessed him instead of, and finally he said, I can't, I'm trying to curse him, I can't do it, God won't let me. There are no more Moabites. Have you noticed? There's no flag of Moab today. There is a flag of Israel, against all odds. The only ancient national entity to survive through history, literally to be resurrected. God says, do you remember what happened back then? From Shittim to Gilgal, meaning from the beginning to the end, from the start to the finish, I have taken care of you in order that you might know the righteous acts of the Lord. So that's his case against them. What have I done to you? It's interesting how people don't think of themselves as letting God down. Because God is so big and he's so powerful and so impervious to pain. How can you let him down? I mean, I know the feeling of being let down. I know the feeling of trusting someone and having them stab me in the back. Worse than that, I know the feeling of doing it to somebody else and getting busted for it later. We know those feelings, but does God feel those feelings? I mean, does God really feel stabbed in the back? Does God feel let down by people that he loves? Does God have these kind of feelings? Does he have feelings? You multiply your feelings times righteousness, times infinity. I mean, he has the capacity to feel pain that you have no idea of. And he feels it all voluntarily. We're forced to feel pain. God, every bit of pain he feels, and he talks a lot about pain. He talks a lot about his own pain. His own pain at having his friends and his family turn against him. He feels it all voluntarily. He volunteered for every bit of it. That's an awesome reality. Yes, God feels it. And yes, when we sin, we just plain let him down. You say, well, it also brings on the wrath of God, right? Yes, it does bring on the wrath of God. Yes, eventually he will pour out his wrath in righteousness against all ungodliness. Yes, that's true. But that's not the point here. The point here is he's just plain, flat, point blank, disappointed. Just like we are at times, just plain hurt and disappointed. Now, sometimes it's better to think about that as a Christian than it is to say, well, what will God do to me if I disobey him? In other words, how much can I get away with before he'll smack me upside the head? But maybe a better question is to ask ourselves, how much do we want to do to him? And how much pain are we going to inflict on him as his people when sin crops up and says, yeah, do this? And we know full well it's wrong. You know, a better question to ask is, how much do I want to hurt the Lord by what I'm doing? Because the pain in these words is very, very real. This isn't just poetry. It's not just rhetoric where God indicts these people. This is real pain. Read it through the whole Bible. There's never an indicator that God doesn't feel pain. Every indicator is he does volunteer for pain much worse than we have because he loves us. Anyway, so he brings this against the people because they have, to be honest, turned against him and let him down. People actually push to the point where he really has to discipline, pushing the envelope like little kids. Well, then verses 6 and 7, what the response is, this is from the defendant. Now, see, the Lord is accusing, and he's right. And now in the defendant, verses 6 and 7, What shall I come to the Lord and bow myself before the God on high? Shall I come to him with burnt offerings, with yearling calves? Does the Lord take delight in thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil? Oil is very expensive stuff. And the oil, of course, isn't 30 weight, okay? The oil he's talking about is olive oil, which was quite expensive to make. They made it in these big presses, and it was useful for all kinds of things. And it was a very standard commodity in those days. 10,000 rivers of oil represents an outrageous, unimaginable amount of money and blessing. Is that what God wants? He wants 10,000 rivers of oil? You see how it builds? With what shall I come to Yahweh, says the defendant? What do you want out of me? You ever feel like that? Do people ever ask God that? What do you want out of me? Shall I bow myself before the God on high? I know what I'll do. I'll bow down. Or maybe I should come with burnt offerings. Now, the ante is going up. You see this? You see the intensity is going up. We've gone from bowing down to making a sacrifice. And then yearling calves. These are a little more expensive yet. And then thousands of rams. Now he's reaching out into a huge amount of money. And 10,000 rivers of oil. You see how it's rising here? This is an increase in the intensity. What does God want? Does he want this? Maybe more. Maybe more. Maybe more. And he gets even higher. He gets up to taking a human life, which God never asked for. Never told the people of Israel that he would take a human life. Back when Abraham offered Isaac, God never intended to take Isaac. Shall I offer my firstborn for my rebellious acts, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? What do you want, God? What do you want? The defendant responds in frustration. What do you want? More burnt offerings? More sacrifices? A child? What is it going to cost me to get you off my back? To get what I want? What's it going to cost me? This is very subtle because it appears to be sincere, as if nothing is too much to offer to God. You see that? I'll offer anything. Whatever you want, God. Here it is. I'll give you whatever. I'll give you my money. I'll give you my health. I'll give you all this stuff. But you notice that the motivation of it all is not because they really want to. They're buying him off. It's blatant legalism, no understanding of grace at all. But it's subtle because it looks sincere. I'll give you anything. But it's not sincere. There's an agenda in it. And the agenda is me. Me, me. The assumption is that the bargainer is really all right. And they just need to pay a little more to the angry God. What more do you want? I'll give you more. And you keep giving and giving. Under those circumstances, pretty soon you begin to think, well, God ought to just plain lighten up. He's asking for too much. You see, a person who's thinking like that isn't thinking grace at all. They don't understand that God has forgiven them, if indeed they have repented. They don't understand that you don't buy anything from God, let alone buy his absence. Get away from me. I'll give you anything you want just to stay off my back and keep the money flowing. God is not some pagan idol that you manipulate to get what you want. But yet this looks very holy. You want to know something? A lot of people deal with God that way. And you find out because as soon as things go wrong in their life, they say, what more does God want? I'll do anything for him. What they mean is, I'll do anything to get what I want out of him. But they won't say that out loud. In fact, a lot of times we don't even understand that ourselves. As human beings, we've been so used to believing our own clippings that we're not even aware that we do this. It's amazing, too, because God loves us anyway, right through it. Humanity loves to cast itself this way as the beleaguered, hard-working, hard-pressed good guys who will do anything to keep God happy, but who are growing weary of his incessant demands. Oh, I'm so weary. I'm so weary of serving God. Hogwash. It's so me-centered, you see. It's so abysmally, radically self-centered, that whole line of thinking. And yet it permeates our culture. You get people shaking their fist at God, so mad at him because he let something happen. Some bad thing, some horrible thing has to do with living in a fallen world. People shake their fists at God. People who've never been to church a day in their life, been mad at God most of their life, they shake their fist at him because some bad thing happens in their family or in their life. They get so mad at him. Totally self-centered. But look at verse 8. Micah says, he has told you. What does he want? More sacrifices, more external stuff, more religious stuff. I'll do it, I'll do it, I'll do it. No, verse 8, he's told you, O man, what is good. Now, what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness or mercy in the Old King James, and to walk humbly with your God? You sure you don't want another sacrifice? Easier to make a sacrifice than to walk humbly with your God. See, now this is the crux of the issue. It is easier to make another sacrifice, go to church one more time, increase the tithing check. I have nothing against that. Increase the tithing check. It's easier to do all that stuff, you see, than it is to actually live in a way that does justice to brothers and sisters and shows kindness and mercy to people who don't deserve it and walks humbly with God. Because you see, those issues, this is where God probed. I went to a chiropractor recently, and he found a muscle. I injured myself years ago on my left shoulder. And one of the rotator cuff muscles to this day on my shoulder still hurts. And I re-injured it getting tossed from a horse a couple weeks ago, which didn't help. He said, you're riding horses? I said, yeah. He says, that's good job security for me. I said, okay. So he worked on this muscle. And he probed this muscle with this thumb and forefinger, you know, and he put this little stuff on there, and he's going, he says, so how does that feel? And I go, it feels great. And, you know, I'm being manly. I'm gripping that thing so hard, I just can't stand it. And he's pressing on this muscle. He's going, it's going to feel better in a minute. Yeah. That's what God is doing here, except it's not a physical muscle. See, it's the selfishness muscle that's inside of us. God goes, you know, let me press on this. This is all I want, he says. I want you to live with integrity and love and humility before me and with the people that you live around. Well, they weren't willing to do that because they really didn't have a relationship with God in the first place. He was kind of an idol to them, someone they needed to keep off their back, someone they needed to keep happy. And as long as everything was going fine, that was fine with them. But when he began to really press in, justice, the Hebrew word means to be truly ethical and just and fair, not sliding the scales in your own favor. He gets into that in a minute. The word love is chesed. You guys remember that word, don't you? You should remember it. Powerful word, chesed. It means covenant love, loving. It's translated loving kindness usually, or never-ending love. It is a devotion to people. That's what God is looking for, and walking humbly. And interesting, the Hebrew word for humbly here means modestly or circumspectly. You know what circumspect means? It means to walk wisely, looking at all of the contingent issues and doing what you know is the right thing to do in light of what's really important to you. And he says, that's the way I want you to live with me. And what it means is walking, living in such a way that what God thinks is the most important thing in your life. Not always falling flat on your face, spending hours and hours eating dust like some monk out in the middle of nowhere wearing, you know, mohair shirts and all kinds of stuff. It's this business of humility and saying, I care what God thinks. I really care what he thinks just simply because of who he is, just because he loves me and I love him. God says, that's what I'm looking for. People say, what do you want, God? And Micah says, haven't you been reading? Haven't you been listening? God has told you what he wants. This is what he wants. Sacrifice is good, but it's no excuse for integrity. It's no excuse. It's no replacement. So he probes on that muscle. Ah! Well, you know that Israel, especially northern Israel, did not respond at all to these words. And the Lord knew they would not. Verse 9, so the voice of the Lord will call to the city, and it is sound wisdom to hear or fear thy name. Heed the rod, and the one who holds it is the NIV rendering. It's a difficult verse to translate, and either of those will work out just fine. What it means is God has spoken, listen up. That's what he's saying. Verse, the latter part of verse 9, hear, O tribe, who has appointed its time. Look at, God is at work. Heed the rod and the one who wields it. Is there yet a man in the wicked house, along with the treasures of wickedness, and a short measure that is cursed? Can I justify wicked scales and a bag of deceptive weights? The rich men of the city are full of violence. Their residents speak lies. Their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. So also I will make you sick and strike you down, desolating you because of your sins. He says, I can't stand crooked business practices, what he's talking about. Short measure, verse 10. Wicked scales, bag of deceptive weights. You know, they didn't use a lot of cash. What they did is they weighed things out. And of course, in those days, they didn't get all their weights from the same place. They were all supposed to be the same. They were supposed to be a standard measure. But, you know, all you had to do was shave a little bit off here and add a little bit over there. And pretty soon, you were making a whole lot more money than was honest. And no one would know the difference. It's like keeping two sets of books. No one else knows the difference, but you know. And God says, and I know. And you're cheating. He says, how long am I going to put up with this? Not much longer. Verse 14, you will eat, but you won't be satisfied. And your filth or vileness will be in your midst. And you will try to remove for safekeeping, but you will not preserve anything. And what you do preserve, I will give to the sword. And you will sow, but you won't reap. And you'll tread the olive, but you will not anoint yourself with oil. See, it's the olive oil again. You'll grind down those olives in those presses and stuff, but you're not going to have the time to use the oil. And the grapes, you'll step on the grapes and you'll crush the grapes, but you won't drink the wine. In other words, you're going to work really hard. It's going to look really good, but somehow all the enjoyment that you're looking for isn't going to happen. The statutes of Omri and all the works of the house of Ahab are observed. Now remember Omri and Ahab in northern Israel? Horrible dynasty. Ahab was Jezebel's husband, and they were responsible for bringing all this Baal worship into northern Israel. The statutes of Omri and all the works of the house of Ahab, they are observed. You're paying attention to these guys, and in their devices you walk. Therefore, I will give you up for destruction, your inhabitants for derision, and you will bear the reproach of my people. Interesting how human mentors become far more important to us than God himself. Omri, Ahab. You know, if you go to Israel today, they speak well of King Ahab. You read the histories. Ahab was well thought of in the world during his day. He's a horrible idolater. If you read the Bible, you find out he was a terrible man. But politically and militarily, he was quite respectable. And I was interested on the last trip we took to Israel that the guide actually spoke rather nicely about King Ahab. I was surprised, but then I suddenly realized, of course, because the guide is not a Christian and probably doesn't take the Old Testament all that seriously. In fact, we asked him one time later, and a real nice fellow, but doesn't take the Bible very seriously, and only saw Ahab in his political, as a political leader. And as a political leader, he was something of a success, which is all that matters in the world. And pretty soon you get mentors that are successful in the world, and that's all that matters. And they can be utterly godly, but we want to be just like them. And you know, if you do that, you know what'll happen? You'll end up under the same judgment as the old life. So watch your mentors. Omri
Ahab, oh yeah, they were hot stuff in their day. But you don't want to be like them. These folks did. They thought, oh, we want to be like Omri and Ahab. And sure, they had their problems, but hey, you know, we want to be successful. Let's mix worldly success with spiritual success. I'm sure we can make this work. I mean, God has said it won't, but we'll keep trying. We can make this work. Now, he ends chapter 6 with this judgment. You see how it goes? He starts with the case, speaks God's accusation, then the people's response, which is essentially selfish, and God says, wait a minute, it's not what I'm after, not the surface stuff. I'm going for the real issues deep down inside, but they're not listening. So verses 9 to 16, God says, the axe is going to fall. Now, chapter 7, Micah speaks for himself in verse 1, and it's wonderful. Listen to what he says. It's sad, but it's wonderful that there's a righteous man willing to say it. Woe is me, says Micah, for I am like the fruit pickers and the grape gatherers. There is not a cluster of grapes to eat or a first ripe fig that I crave so much. Why? Because the godly person has perished from the land. There's no upright person among men, all of them lie in wait for bloodshed. Each of them hunts the other with a net. Concerning evil, they are ambidextrous. Do you see that? They do it just as well with both hands. They're ambidextrous at evil. Anything they want to do. We're learning new skills. We can be evil in several different ways. Isn't this wonderful? They do it well with both hands. The prince asks also the judge for a bribe. The great man speaks the desire of his soul, and they weave it together. The best of them is a briar. And the most upright is a thorn hedge. The day when you post a watchman, your punishment will come, says Micah. And their confusion will occur. Don't trust in your neighbor. Don't have confidence in a friend from her who lies in your bosom. Guard your lips. For son treats father contemptuously. Daughter rises up against her mother. Daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own household. Terrible, terrible times being described. Micah looks all around. What he's really looking for is somebody godly. Do you ever feel that way? I'm looking around, looking for somebody godly. I'm looking for somebody I can trust. Well, you don't feel that way too much. You wouldn't be here tonight. There's at least a few around here that you can trust. And you probably know a lot more. But poor Micah, he was absolutely alone. He says, I'm looking for some fruit, but I don't find any, no spiritual fruit at all. It's quite depressing. The carnality is depressing. Nobody godly. People are totally worldly. They don't think at all about spirituality. And Micah's hurting because of that. But it's interesting he doesn't stay that way. You might say, oh, man, he's going to throw in the towel. What a bummer. He's just going to go live in a cave. He's going to do what Elijah did. Remember Elijah ran all the way to the cave, said, nobody loves God except me. I'm the only one left. Remember? And God had to remind him there were 7,000 he wasn't aware of. But Micah doesn't do that. Micah says in verse 7, but as for me, I will watch expectantly for the Lord. What? Things are going against you, Micah. Yeah, I know. That's why I'm going to have to watch expectantly for the Lord. Yeah, but everything's falling out from under you. Yeah, I know. That's why I'm going to have to tell myself the truth now. I'm going to have to stop trusting what I see around me and just trust what God says. I'm going to have to just fly by my instruments. I will wait for the Lord. I'm trusting Him. I don't care what anybody says Micah. Now, in the next few verses, he speaks for the righteous remnant of Israel. And it is this remnant, it is these real believers that God will eventually vindicate all through history. Micah says, as for me, I'll watch expectantly for the Lord. I'll wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. Don't rejoice over me, O enemy, O my enemy. Though I fall, I will rise. Though I dwell in darkness, the Lord is a light for me. Don't gloat. People gloat over fallen Christians. Don't you do it, my friend. Don't gloat over a fallen believer. If they are a real believer, God will bring them back and you will be sorry for the gloating, whether you're a Christian or a non-Christian. God's covenant people. He says, though I fall, I will rise. Though I dwell in darkness, the Lord is a light for me. Okay, verse 9. And again, speaking of the remnant, I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him. See, this is the mind of a righteous person. If they sin against God, it's not that they never sin against him, it's that they, when they do sin against him, they cop to it. I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I sinned against him until he pleads my case and executes justice for me. He will bring me out to the light and I will see his righteousness. And then my enemy will see and shame will cover who set cover her who said to me, where is Yahweh your God? My eyes will look on her. At that time, she will be trampled down like mire in the streets. And he explains that there will come a day when God's people will rise up and the enemies of God will be destroyed. Verse 14, shepherd your people with your scepter, he speaks to the Lord, the flock of your possession. Now, this is all very hopeful, you see. All the judgment and everything, and yet Micah looks on and he says, but God's going to win, and he will shepherd his people. Shepherd your people with your scepter, the flock of your possession, which dwells by itself in the woodland in the midst of a fruitful field. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as in the days of old. These are all areas of Israel that were just lush and beautiful. And he's saying, hey, let it be like it was in the old days, and it will be someday. As in the days when you came out from the land of Egypt, I will show you miracles. See, this is the Lord speaking. I will do this. I will bless you. Verses 16 and 17. Nations will see and be ashamed, ashamed of all their might. They will put their hand on their mouth. Their ears will be deaf, and so on. And the judgment again against the nations. See, the vindication of the righteous, the repentant faithful, they get vindicated. And the enemies of God that thought they were winning, when God's people were beleaguered and being disciplined, the enemies of God thought they were winning, but it absolutely turns around. And verse 18, who is like thee who pardons iniquity? See, it's the repentant faithful. They've been pardoned. There's this remnant that will come back. Incidentally, Micah means who is like Yahweh. That's what his name means. So verse 18 actually kind of starts with Micah's name. Who is like you who pardons iniquity and passes over the rebellious acts of the remnant of his possession? He does not retain his anger forever because he delights in unchanging love. There's that word chesed again. He delights in it. And he comes back. Even when he disciplines, he comes back in love to the people who really know him. He will again have compassion on us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. Yes, you will cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. You will give truth to Jacob and unchanging love, chesed, to Abraham, which you did swear to our forefathers from the days of old. And indeed he will. Israel will be reborn. Remember Romans 11. We looked at it last time. I want to close with some characteristics that we find in here. These last two chapters are very revealing in a couple of ways. They reveal what God is looking for and didn't find in Israel, and they reveal what Micah was like. Chapter 6 reveals what God was looking for among his people, and it wasn't there, but we still learn something. Chapter 7 reveals a lot about Micah, and we learn something from there. Matter of fact, we learn four things, these four characteristics of maturity. The first one is in chapter 6, verse 5. It's a good memory for God's faithfulness. You see, God said, remember, 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 but they weren't remembering. So what do we learn from that? We learn that it's a characteristic of maturity and growth to have a good memory for God's faithfulness. To remember when God has answered your prayers. My mom said to me just this last time when she was here, she said, my memory is really, really good. It's just very short. Isn't that the way we are? Isn't that the way we are? We have a great memory for stuff we've done. Matter of fact, we get upset if other people don't remember stuff we've done. But we can't quite remember all the faithfulness of God, especially when things aren't going so good right now. It is the mark of a wise, mature believer that they have a good memory for the faithfulness of God in the past. When was the last time you sat down and really made a list of all the good stuff God has done in your life? All the good things. Well, yeah, but there's some undone good things. But I'm not talking about the undone stuff. I'm talking about all the stuff that you know you can look back on and say, God answered this prayer, this prayer, this prayer. He got me through this situation. He's gotten me this far. That's a mark of maturity, to interpret your life in light of the blessings instead of in light of the difficulties. You know how we know that? Because he said, I wanted you to remember. And you know what he does? He quotes the Balaam-Balak story. Do you know how far back that was? 600 years. He had expected them to remember. He expected the nation to pass this faith on from generation to generation about a story that happened 600 years ago. He said, I expect you to remember it. I have done it. You need to remember this because there's going to be times when you think I'm not watching. And so the only way to deal with that is to go back to the times when you know I helped you. And then you'll be reminded that I'm faithful. So a wise person remembers way back. Way back. You say, well, yeah, but what has he done for me recently? Infidel? No. But that's the way we think. A good memory for God's faithfulness. It's an interesting thing. We forget a couple of things. You don't have to write these down, but we forget that he has done so much, and we forget that he didn't owe us a thing. Not a thing. I mean, you say, yeah, but he's done some good stuff for me. You know, I can name a few things he's done for me, but boy, you know, he's done a whole lot more good stuff for so-and-so. Man, they're doing so much better than me, and I want some of their stuff. How come he's not giving me what they've got? You forget how much he's done for us, and you forget that he didn't owe us a thing. Not a thing. He didn't owe us a thing. He could let us all go to hell. He doesn't owe us a thing. And even after saving us, he doesn't owe us anything. Even after saving us from hell, he doesn't owe us anything. But he gives us breath every morning. Sunshine. Air conditioning. A good memory for God's faithfulness, characteristic number one. Here's number two. It's an internal understanding of holiness. Chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. An internal understanding of holiness, which these people didn't have. They understood religion. They did not understand walking with God. He said, look, this is what I'm after. I'm after the way you treat each other. I'm after the way you live before me in humility and care what I think and care what I say. It's not the number of your sacrifices. Sacrifice was good, but not as a substitute for integrity. My friend, you're not right with God if you're not living with integrity. It's as simple as that. You're not right with God if you treat people like trash, if you treat people like something you use for your profit. You're not right with God. I don't care how much you go to church. That's what he's saying there, see? So a mark of maturity, not just a good memory for God's faithfulness, but an internal sense of holiness, where the holiness starts from the inside. The problem is we need to want this. And to the extent that we don't want it, to that extent we should be praying, saying, Lord, I see big portions of my life that don't want anything to do with you. Please forgive me. Set those straight. See, that's deep down inside. It's not this surface religion thing. Listen to what this guy says. It's really good. Let it never be forgotten. This is with regard to integrity versus external religion, the internal realities that are simple and not very flashy versus the external stuff that we focus on sometimes. He says this, let it never be forgotten that glamour is not greatness. Applause is not fame. Prominence is not eminence. The man of the hour is not apt to be the man of the ages. A stone may sparkle, that doesn't make it a diamond. People may have money, that doesn't make them a success. It is, listen to this, it is what the unimportant people do that really counts and determines the course of history. The greatest forces in the universe are never spectacular. Summer showers are more effective than hurricanes, but they get no publicity. The world would soon die except for the fidelity, the loyalty, and the consecration of those whose names are unhonored and unsung. Quiet people who do what's right when no one else is looking, and there's no one to give them a reward, and there's no one going to put your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone. You don't get that by doing what's right anyway. Or the cover of Time magazine or anything else. Most of the people who've been on the covers of those magazines are not on their way to heaven, with a few notable exceptions. No, the world's not going to beat a path to your door for living with integrity and internal holiness, but it counts. It counts. It counts forever. That's what God is looking for. And when he came to Israel and he said, I don't find any of this. There's no mishpat. There's no justice. There's no fairness. There's no chesed. There's no love. There's no sense of devotion to one another. And there's no humility before me. None. Nobody cares what I think. I will destroy them. Internal understanding of holiness. A wise Christian has that and develops it. Here's number three, a deep desire for real fellowship. And that's what Micah says in chapter 7. He says, I'm looking around like somebody looking for fruit. I'm starving. I don't have any. And I'm looking around for somebody else who loves God, and there's nobody around. It is the mark of a real believer, as painful as it may be at times, it's the mark of a real believer to want fellowship. They want to be around other Christians. It is the mark of a person who's not walking with God to not want to be around other Christians, especially a person who has been walking with God and is no longer walking with God. And we know this feeling, don't we? I remember when I used to walk with the Lord, right? And then for a period of time, I didn't walk with the Lord, and I didn't want to go to church, and I didn't want to hear anybody else talk about it. I didn't want fellowship. But when I was walking with God, especially when I came back, I craved it. I wanted to be around somebody else who cared about God, wanted to talk about him. That's what Micah's looking for in chapter 7. He says, I'm looking for some fruit, but I'm looking around. It's not physical fruit he's looking for. It's spiritual fruit. If you've never had that feeling, and you're really walking with God, you've just never been separated from Christian fellowship. But boy, I'll tell you, it's a pain in the neck. When you're stuck out there and you don't know anybody and you can't find, and you come across somebody even though you never saw them before, and even though in other circumstances you might not want to connect with them, but you find out they're a Christian and they're the only other Christian you know, you're buddies. It really is that way. It's like, a Christian, all right. Well, that's what Micah's looking for, and it is the mark of a believer. It's a very great danger sign when you don't care about fellowship anymore. Now, we've been sated in this country with fellowship. We take it for granted. We don't think much about it. And because we have so much at times, we lose track of this truth. And you can go to church too much, and you can sometimes get yourself just kind of inundated with so much fellowship that you start to get jaded and calloused. And that is a problem in the American church, but it's not much of a problem in other countries, I'll tell you. Like behind the old Iron Curtain. Again, you talk to people back there, the one thing you will not find in church, they tell you, is an empty seat. They pack. They just pack out. Fellowship, a desire for fellowship. You have that? Here's number four. And it's in chapter 7, verses 7 to 20. It's a secure hope. It's a secure hope in God's plan. A real believer knows that God's going to win. A real believer knows that they're going to be okay. A real believer trusts that God is going to get them through. A real believer says, I will hope in God. It's a terribly depressing carnal situation that Micah faces in the first half of chapter 7. But in the second half, he says, but I will wait for God. And it is the mark of a believer to hope. Jot down Jeremiah 29:11. That's where he says, after the 70 years, I will bring you back. God says through Jeremiah, we'll get to that when we get into Jeremiah, but he says to Jeremiah, after 70 years, I'll bring you back because I know the plans I have for you. Plans for your welfare and not for your calamity. I am not finished with you. I will bring you back. And a real believer knows that, and a real believer comes back. And that's why Micah is such an outstanding man. Hope is confident expectation of a blessing in the future. That's what hope is, biblically. It's confident expectation that there is a blessing coming. You may say, well, it looks like a long way off. Thank you very much. Well, it may be a while. But hope is part of being a believer. Read Romans 5. We won't read it tonight. Jot it down. Romans 5, the first 10 verses. Check it out. He says, we even have hope when we're in tribulation. Because we know that God's working on us. Secure hope in God's plan. A good memory for God's faithfulness, an internal understanding of holiness, a deep desire for real fellowship, and a secure hope in God's plan. Do you have those things this evening? If you don't, get them back as a believer in Jesus Christ. You're going to need them. Our culture is very similar to the 8th century B.C. in Israel. Let's bow our heads, close our eyes. Father, thank you for the words of Micah and the other prophets as well as we continue to study these words. Words from another culture, words from another country, a different language, a different type of literature, Hebrew poetry. Words from another age. 2,500 years ago, 2,800 years ago, Lord. Words that no one else, it seems, in this world wants to know very much about, but words of life, words of the prophets. Father, let them be prophetic indeed for us as we read them and as we think them through, because we don't want to be like the people of ancient Israel, though they were supposed to have been a covenant community, they did not grasp the covenant at all. We want to grasp the covenant, Father, with you and hang on tight. And we thank you that your Holy Spirit has given to us this desire. We want to consciously encourage it. Teach us, Lord, how to think and how to be and how to feel and how to respond in life, moment by moment, day by day. Use these words to do it. We thank you for Micah. We thank you for these prophets. In Jesus' name, amen.